What should you consider when picking a bank or credit union? Well, the new federal programs to help students in debt and homeowners with underwater mortgages help you. And news about savings bonds. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley has info on these topics and more in this edition of On Your Money. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 1st. So push aside the leftover Halloween candy and belly up to the radio and call us if you have a question about a personal finance matter at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So I had 2 Kit Kats for breakfast. How about you?
I'm still kind of getting out of my costume from last night.
What were you?
I went as a sexy certified financial planner.
Well, you didn't even have to put on a costume.
Well, that's what I thought, but everyone got the certified financial planner part, and nobody else got. Even Rachel, my wife. Actually, especially Rachel, did not get the other part about it.
So well, better luck next year, Kevin.
I'll just go as a ghost next year.
Well, you know, lots of stuff going on in our financial worlds here. There are 2 new government programs that President Obama talked about last week that are intended to help homeowners who are underwater in their mortgages and those who owe on their student loans. So what can you tell us about these?
The housing program is for those who are underwater and want to refinance but can't because of various circumstances. It's basically an extension of the HARP, Homeowners Assistance Refinance Program, that was launched in 2009. And what they hoped was that about 4 to 5 million homeowners would be helped. About 1 million were helped, and only about 72,000 of those were underwater. And it was typically because those people were in too deep. They owed way more on the home than the home was worth. The fees were really high. The people had low credit scores. And so the new program that was just announced last week has lower fees to refinance. It has less stringent requirements to get in as part of the program, and the loan-to-value requirement that was keeping many people from refinancing is a much more easier program for them to be a part of. So the important part about it, though, is that the banks will not have to buy back the mortgages from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Many times to do this in the old program, the banks would have to go back and buy back the mortgage that had already gone bad, judging by the loan-to-value, et cetera. And in this program, the banks won't have to do that.
Who is eligible for the program?
The mortgage has to be owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and you can go to FreddieMac.com or FannieMae.com, and we'll have links to those website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, to find out if your mortgage is indeed owned. It's a little scary. You can type in your own personal information. You have to verify that you are indeed the homeowner in question, and then those websites will tell you if your mortgage at the address in question is owned by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, and therefore if you are eligible. You also cannot have refinanced in the last 2.5 years, and you cannot have any late payments on the mortgage in the last 6 months, and no more than 1 late payment in the last year. The program technically starts on November 15th, and it's been extended to run through 2013. Your first steps, if you are interested in this and you do want to try to refinance and get a lower interest rate, even though you might be way underwater or you might have credit problems, is to contact your current lender. But remember, the current lender does not have to agree to the terms. It's voluntary, so if it's in the lender's interest to do it, they'll go ahead and proceed, but otherwise you may be out of luck.
Okay. What kind of help is coming to those who owe on student loans?
This one is called Know Before You Owe. Know Before You Owe, and it rhymes, so it must be a good program.
We'll remember that.
Yes. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is basically a new agency created by through the White House. This is also an expansion of the current programs, but it is only applicable to federal loans. It requires more disclosure to borrowers right now, but it allows more lenient terms for income-based repayment of the loans. Starting in 2014, federal lenders, federal student loan lenders, rather, will only require up to 10% of income to be paid to keep the loans current on federal loans. And if you can keep the loans current for 20 years, they'll be forgiven. The old program had 25 years. You can go to consumerfinance.gov. And again, we'll have the links up to that website at onyourmoney.com. You can also go to ibrinfo.org right now to see if your loan does qualify and your income is low enough so that you can get a smaller payment and still qualify for it as well. What is also a little frightening bit about this is in the official government press release for this program, they said, if you are eligible for this program, the government will contact you after next year.
Okay. We have a caller, in fact, who has a question about student loans, so seems this would be a good time to take that call. Alex in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Are you a student?
I was a student.
Okay.
I'm working right now. And my question is about student loans. I'm in a little bit of a different situation. I have the opportunity to pay off the bulk of my student loans, about $30,000, this year in one lump sum. And I'm wondering if what the advantages, disadvantages to doing that would be rather than maybe spacing out the payments over the next few years and how that might affect credit rating, and that's it.
I'm sorry, I missed that last word, Alex.
Oh, and how that either paying it off in one lump sum or over the course of, say, the next 3 to 5 years might affect my credit rating.
Okay.
Is there some issue that forces you to pay it off right now? Is it a now or never kind of issue, Alex? Or can do you have the cash on hand and you're just deciding where to put it and if you should put it toward your student loans?
Correct. Yeah, the cash is on hand and it's just a matter of deciding what to do with it.
Okay. And you are gainfully employed?
Yes.
Okay. Does your gainful employer offer a retirement plan at work?
No, I'm contracted. It's through an LLC that I have.
So you're self-employed.
Yes.
Okay. If you have the option, I would rather have you do two things with the money. One is take half of the cash and just put it in a checking and savings account. I'd like you to have at least a year's worth of living expenses, especially since you are self-employed, before you start paying these loans off. And the reason being is that yes, it will help your credit rating a little bit to pay these off, and yes, you will save some money in the interest. But if you pay them off and something comes up where you need the money for whatever reason, whether you lose your employment or you have some other kind of emergency, you can't go back to the good people at the student lending company and say, hey, remember that money I gave you? I'm going to need that back. I promise to start making the payments again. But you can do that while you have the loans outstanding. So until you get a year's worth of living expenses, and for most people that's probably close to $50,000, even for younger single people, I would not pay those loans off any faster than you have to. If you really want to make a big difference in your life, open up an IRA, and depending on how much you're making, you may save anywhere from 20 to 30% of the amount you deposit in the IRA in taxes, which will far exceed what you're paying in interest. And so that's a way to put a small money aside in an IRA for yourself, get some money going for retirement, and then still just make the regular payments until you get about a year's worth of living expenses set aside.
Okay. Yeah, great.
All right. Thank you, Alex, and good luck to you. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And we're cleaning out the email box with answers to three questions from shows that aired over the past few weeks. The first one from Steven says that, Kevin, you performed a disservice to reality when you said that traditional 100-watt light bulbs would not be available after the first of the year. What are you trying to do here, Kevin?
Well, we've had extensive research and studies on what our listeners want here, and nobody asks for more reality. They said they're good on reality. They have enough. They get reality all day, every day. They get reality in the middle of the night. They get reality from everyone they love and many people they don't care about. So they said they don't want any more reality. They're good on that. Thank you. But in an answer to Stephen's question, we had said that traditional incandescent 100-watt light bulbs would not be available. And it really depends on one's definition of traditional. There will be a much more energy-efficient incandescent 100-watt light bulb still available. It will be more expensive, but it's about maybe 20 to 30% more efficient than the ones that we typically buy for 29 cents at the supermarket and then throw away after 6 months. But eventually, all wattages will have to either be this or the LED or the CFL, LCDs and CFLs. But if you want more information on the changes coming after January 1st of 2012, you can go to ftc.gov/lightbulbs.
Yeah, so the dispute here is whether it's the traditional 100-watt bulb or something else.
Right. Yeah. I like mine traditional, old-fashioned, just the way Thomas Edison invented it, hot wire, piece of glass. That's all I need. And so you're right. It's not a traditional in that sense.
All right. The next one is from Lori, who wants to know if your formula for financial independence includes taxes and inflation.
Basically, yes, mostly because I'm not counting on a ton of inflation. And for most people, being financially independent as a middle income spending person, you generally don't pay very much in federal income taxes. It's not a big portion of your expenditures. Again, what you do is take your current monthly expenses, subtract any guaranteed payments that you expect to receive, either Social Security or pension payments, and then multiply that number by 200, the remaining number, if you're in your 60s, and about 300 if you're not in your 60s and you want that money to last at least as long as you do. So it assumes that the earnings on the money that you get, the investment earnings, are just going to about equal inflation, and that's what most people should do in this situation anyway. Don't include home equity in the equation either. Many people ask that question. So to give you an example, let's say you are spending $5,000 per month, and you expect to get $2,000 per month in Social Security. That leaves $3,000 left over that you have to cover from your own savings. So you multiply the $3,000 times 200 if you're in your 60s. You should have about $600,000 in savings before you can consider yourself ready to retire. And if it's you're younger than that, you should multiply it by 300. So you need about $900,000 before you can be financially independent.
And finally, Kevin, we are still getting requests from people who would like a copy of your super popular mini money book, Making the Most of Your Mortgage. Do you have any of those left?
Yes, we just got a couple still left in the Gutenberg press. We're printing them off as we speak. I wanted to get them printed up in a way that, you know, like in elementary school in the 1670s, that it had that ink that you wanted to always smell on the mimeograph machine, but apparently those don't exist anymore. Pledgers at any level during our last pledge show received a free copy of the On Your Money mini money book, Making the Most of the of your mortgage. It talked about what to do with your house, with your mortgage, how much you should take out, what to do with the proceeds if you refinance, and how to get the best deal on the mortgage. And if you send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org, they'll get all the information and they'll still eventually get one of those out to you.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We will get to your questions, your calls for Kevin in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And coming up on the program, some news about savings bonds and tips on choosing a bank or a credit union. But now we go to your calls for Kevin, and our first caller is John in Lake Geneva. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Recently sold my house. Talking to a couple of different financial people. One's touting a 5.25 30-year loan. Another one is touting a 3.98% 7-1 ARM or some sort of a balloon type thing, which doesn't sound like it has a cap on it. initially I thought, well, that sounds great. I can't see rates going up that much, you know, over the next several years given the economy. But then in the last show I was listening to, there was some mention made that banks are looking for ways to make some money, and maybe they're going to start looking at interest rates. What do I do?
Well, one thing you could do is explain to me more about your situation, because I'm confused. It's not that difficult to do. Okay, so you sold your house.
Sold it. We've got an offer on another house, so I'm going to be looking to, you know, get a loan, pay down my previous loan, you know.
So you're looking at what terms you should get for a new mortgage, right?
Yeah, well, what's the best thing for me? Do I go with a fixed? Should I go with this adjustable 3.98? Because it sounds really tantalizing because it's low, but the impression I got is that with something, I guess it's a balloon of some sort, that there's no cap on how high the rate could go.
It's usually there is a cap. There's a cap on both how much it can rise in a specific year and a cap in how much it can rise altogether. But 3.98 isn't that spectacular. Mm-hmm. Did you look into just straight 30-year fixed-rate loans, John?
I did that, and I got a 5.25 rate thrown at me.
Hmm. Well, I would, first of all, duck.
You don't want that.
You don't want that. And second of all, start shopping around, because the traditional 30-year mortgage rate now is about 1% lower than that. And maybe there's some history or issues there that are precluding you from getting that rate.
Well, you know, yes, my credit wasn't all that rosy. I had a couple of outstanding things, and I just paid those down to zero and was told, you know, request some sort of a statement saying you have a zero balance here, like some fast credit thingy or whatever, which might bump my credit score off X amount.
How many different lenders did you go to? You just went to two different ones, right?
Well, I went to the previous lender that I had for my previous house, and then, of course, we're in a different town right now, and our realtor steered us to a particular bank in town.
Okay. I would go to another bank or credit union and see what that one done on your own says. And if it came down to it, I guess offhand, I'm sorry, say again how long the 3.98 was fixed for?
I believe it was a 7-1 ARM they were throwing at me.
Hmm. And can you give me a rough idea of what the amount of the mortgage is going to be?
Oh.
How much you're going to borrow?
Let's see. The house, 320. We're going to throw 100 at it, maybe 220-ish.
Okay. Offhand, I would say you're probably better off in the long run going with the 5.25 fix, because you're going to cap how much you're going to pay for that. And if we do get higher interest rates and higher inflation down the road, you'll be very happy that you have that thing capped out for 30 years. If you say, well, I don't like the extra interest cost for that right now. 7 years is a long time to keep that fixed. The only problem is if interest rates rise in the future, you're not only going to have a harder time refinancing at that 5.25, but you're also going to have a problem even selling the house if you can't make the payment for whatever reason. So if I'd first of all check another bank or credit union, and I'd look at another bank or credit union until you get the same answer four times. And then if it were up to me, I would go with the higher fixed rate and just lock that in and know for sure that you're never going to have a higher payment for the next 360 months. And then finally, if you do have to go with the ARM, make sure you know how much it can rise in a given year and overall.
Good luck to you, John. Thank you very much for the call. Michael in West Bend is with us now. Hello, Michael.
Hi, guys. Thanks very much for taking my call. Love the show.
Thanks for calling.
My question is, I recently got engaged, and I opened up a credit card to make the purchase of my engagement ring because I was able to sign a credit card that was offering 24 months, no interest. So I made my purchase and paid everything off, paid the credit card back down to zero, and now I'm planning on closing the card. But when I asked the company and asked to close the account, they told me that it hurt my credit score to close this account. So now my question is, would it hurt my credit score more to close this credit card, which has had a great history? I think I've had it open for under a year. Or would it hurt it more to have this $10,000 line of credit just floating out there unused?
That is so benevolent of the good people at the credit card company to be concerned about your score.
They're great people.
They really. That's just sweet. That's real. I'm tearing up here a little bit. I'm sorry, Michael. Give me a moment. Okay. Yeah, they're full of it. It might hurt your credit score for a little bit, and it won't be for very long. Typically, credit scores are predicated on the amount of credit that you have and the percentage of that is available to you, and do you have a history of maxing out that availability at every single moment. And closing a card can hurt it slightly, but it sounds like if you get this really good deal the first time around and your credit is still in the same situation, it won't hurt it that badly. I would say this, though. When anyone closes a credit card, we'll revert back to the old Seinfeld episode where George Costanza took control of a relationship he was having with a girl where he was worried he's going to be dumped, and he broke up with her first, the preemptive breakup. You want to make everyone aware who cares in your credit bureau that you broke up with the credit card company, not they broke up with you, so that the termination and the closure was at the customer's request, not yours. So make sure that after you do close it, if you do decide to close it, you go back into your credit report at annualcreditreport.com. You can get the raw data there. Once free per bureau per year, and go back in there and make sure that it notes that the account was closed at the customer's request. And after a few months, you probably won't see any difference on your credit card or your credit history.
Excellent,
Michael.
Thank
before you
guys
before
so
you go, Michael, are you living happily ever after now?
We are. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So far.
Well, congratulations.
So far, I've been married happily for most of the 13 years Rachel and I've been married. So far is probably the best way to look at that, and a lot of other things.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and many happy anniversaries to come. Michelle in Portage is with us. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin.
I'm hoping
you can give me a little bit of guidance here that I can share with my son. He's a senior down at the UW-Milwaukee, and he's majoring in business with a minor in finance. He has been kind of looking into getting into an internship. He's gone to a couple job fairs, and there are these investment companies that say they would give him an internship, and they take him in, and they'll give him training. And to me, it pretty much sounds like he would be selling their product. And he mentioned something about how they said, well, you know, you have to get so much money in, and you probably get your family and friends, you know, to invest with our company. I guess I'm just wondering if you can give some direction as to if this is something that you would suggest maybe to your own children, you know, if they were in this situation of getting into, or if you would suggest maybe some other sort of internship with another company.
I love that question. Would you recommend your children do this, Kevin?
Yeah, just the 7-year-old. She's a little more aggressive, and she's a little more. She won't give up. She's more tenacious. So this would be the kind of job she could do as a first grader. And that actually gets back to my point, Michelle. This job, that supposed internship, that really is just about. Here's the cynical take on that.
And that's what I'd like to hear.
Okay, good. Well, you came to the right place. What these companies want to do is take advantage of fresh-faced, bright, scrubbed people like your son and say, hey, I'm getting in. We're a Fortune 500 company and blah, 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 and look at how tall our building is, and you can work for us, and you can have a job unlike all of your other friends who don't have jobs coming out of college. You can come work for us. And the company wins one of two ways, either way. First of all, he's successful. And he makes them a lot of money, makes money for himself. That is highly unlikely to happen. Nothing against your son. It's just most of the people who take these positions wash out fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And when they wash out fairly quickly, your perception of this is right. Already, all of his friends and family, including you, are in as customers to the company, and they're out very little just in terms of the training costs, and he's completely jaded and dissatisfied about, you know, the whole idea of being a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say this. I would look at every other opportunity out there, and then if nothing else is there and this type of position still exists, I would consider it. But it will always be there. The reason that these types of positions are offered to college students with no experience. And, you know, a college diploma is great, but it doesn't have the weight that it once had 30 years ago. So just having a college degree doesn't get people a lot of consideration for a job as well. So I would have him look at a lot of other different places. I would, once he decides what he wants to do, if it were me, I would go to all the places and then see if he can get hired. And if he can't get hired by them, I would say, well, I'll tell you what, can I just work here for free for 6 months? And worst case scenario, he'll get a nice 6 months experience of knowing what he wants to do. He's already broke now, right?
Right, yeah, in debt, yes.
Yep. So being broke for another 6 months, it won't be the end of him, but he will get some good experience, and they'll hopefully get some help out of him and just say, look, I'm willing to work for free. And if I work for free after 6 months and I decide I want to work here and you decide you want to hire me, let's talk about something. But there's, you know, I just want to get the experience and hands-on and help out here if I can.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle. Good luck to you and to your son. It's time now for an update, Kevin, to a favorite investment of On Your Money listeners. What's new?
Well, one of the reasons their favorite investments is because they're so confusing and they're always changing. So they need to tune in to get the latest updates and information. They're called Series I Savings Bonds. They are a direct issue of the United States government. There is no state tax on the interest, which to many investors in Wisconsin, that means it's like getting a CD at an extra higher rate of about 0.5%. Everybody knows about the double E. These are the I bonds. The I bonds have a fixed component and an inflation-adjusted component. So every 6 months, the interest rate on the inflation-adjusted component changes, and it's set every May 1st and November 1st.
So what's the new rate as of today, November 1st?
Well, apparently, the good people at the Treasury are still sleeping off their sugar high from trick-or-treating last night and still haven't come out with a new rate. But based on the previous inflation numbers, I'm thinking this is probably going to be about 3%, maybe a little over 3%, and that's payable on bonds through May 1st. So basically, you get a 3% annualized yield over the next 6 months. And again, that interest is exempt from state taxes. So that's kind of like getting about a 3.5% yield on a similar, let's say, a certificate of deposit. That interest rate is very, very good, but it's just one of the many positive features that we think Series I savings bonds have.
What other positive features?
These are extremely low-risk investments. There are very few investments out there that are as safe as Series I savings bonds. It is a 30-year bond. However, you can get out much earlier than that 30-year maturity and fairly easy. You shouldn't take the money out before 12 months. That's very difficult to do, if almost impossible. But after 12 months, if you pull the money out, you only get a 3-month penalty for early withdrawal, meaning you just lose 3 months worth of interest. And that's just for 5 years. After 5 years, you can pull it out. There's no penalty whatsoever. Also, the bonds credit interest to your account every single year, but you can decide when to declare that interest and pay taxes on it. So you can do it annually if you'd like, or you can do it when you actually liquidate the bond. So it kind of acts like almost an IRA, that the money builds up tax deferred, and then when you finally cash it out, that's when you pay the taxes on it. So ideally, people who are working and in a higher tax bracket right now would build up an accumulation of these bonds, and then when they retire and are more likely to need the money and to be in a lower tax bracket, that's when you cash them out and pay the taxes on it.
Yeah, well, this sounds appealing. How do I know if this is, if the Series I savings bond is right for me?
I hacked into your your online savings accounts, and it is right for you, as it turns
good.
Out. Oh, well, and also, I kept going, and your triglycerides are a little higher than I'd like to see them.
Yeah, I've been working on that. Too many Kit Kats. Anyway, so who might be interested in these bonds?
It's a great alternative to a longer-term CD for people who won't need the money within a year. However, there are limits to it. You can only buy $10,000 per person per year. There's some other ways you can get a little extra, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. You also cannot use these in an IRA. They have to be in kind of an individual account.
And for more information,
go to your local bank or credit union. For 2 more months after January 1st, though, you can only buy them online at treasurydirect.gov. And again, we'll have a link to that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And speaking of banks or credit unions, Kevin, in just a bit during On Your Money, we'll have some some tips on how to pick a bank or credit union, which is right for you. That's coming up. More of your calls as well in just a few moments. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Esther in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for my future. I'm a senior, and I'm planning down the road to probably move out of my home and rent something. What would be the consequences of the money that I would get from selling my home? How would there be taxes on that? I kind of plan to give that money to some of my heirs, and how would that impact that money?
Oh, good question, Esther. But before we get an answer for you, you said you're a senior in Waukesha. Which high school do you go to?
Sorry about that.
No, we get it. We get it.
He's time
ago. All right. Well, very good. And let me ask you this, Esther. Are you selling this because you want to, or you feel like you can't stay in the home, or is it just not right for you, or why would you be selling this?
I'm thinking of doing it right now. Looking to the future.
Down the road.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I would first of all say you're probably not going to owe a great deal of amount if the laws are the same right now. Are you single?
Yes.
Okay. Then you could exclude up to $250,000 in the gains in your home price from capital gains under today's laws, as long as you live there in two of the last 5 years. So you won't pay any taxes under today's laws on $250,000 of gains. And then even then, after the $250,000 level, the rest is going to be taxed at long-term capital gains tax rates, which right now are very low for most people. So the tax bill from selling it will be minimal, if nothing at all. Mm-hmm. In terms of what to do with the money, there's always a temptation at this point to say, okay, I'm going to put it and try to make 6 or 8%. And if you can get that safely, like in a certificate of deposit, I would suggest that. But I would much rather have you concentrate on not losing the money rather than try to make more on top of it, taking a great deal of risk on it, and then potentially losing, 30 or 40% of it if you've had it in too risky of an account. So if it were up to me, I would prefer you to go with long-term certificates of deposit that had a short-term penalty for early withdrawal. And even those Series I savings bonds that we mentioned for a portion of the money, those would be good to accumulate on an annual basis.
Yes. And if I chose to give this money as gifts, so to speak, to my heirs, mm-hmm. how much would that impact? How much could I give them?
You can give them generally up to $13,000 per person per year under today's law. So if you have 3 grandchildren, let's say you could give each one of the grandchildren $13,000. However, I would be cautious about that because sometimes people who want to do this want to do it as a way to protect their assets, if you will, against impoverishment clauses for nursing home expenses. That is effective as long as you've given the money away at least 60 months, at least 5 years before you actually apply for the nursing home and the public assistance. Otherwise, they will include that back into the equation. And if you give the money away appropriately, it's not your money anymore, and the kids can do with it whatever they choose. Now, you might say, well, I can count on them to give it back and help pay for other living expenses. But all of the things being equal in the short time we have here, I'd rather actually have you hang on to the money, keep it safe, and keep it there and help the kids out on a piecemeal basis rather than just trying to get rid of all of your money.
Thank you very much, Esther. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Kerr-Dine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
All from Tuppence, prudently, thriftily, frugally invested in the, to be specific, in the Dawes, Tomes, Mousley, Grubbs, Fidelity, Fiduciary Bank.
I'm Joy Kerr-Dine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. talking, as we always do, or most always do, during this hour with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. And Kevin, Rob Ferret, our producer, finds some very interesting clips of music.
Well, actually, I make my children sing that to me every morning when I wake up, so I'm familiar.
Well,
with it.
That's from Mary Poppins, apparently. I don't remember that classic. But it's about banking, and we're talking about banking because banking's in the news a lot these days with new fees and higher fees and backing off on fees. Some people are shopping around for a new place to do their banking. Why would we want to do this, Kevin?
Well, there are some tangible and intangible motivations to be looking for a new place to save and borrow money. And whether it's financial or philosophical, you're right. A lot of people are looking for new places to do it. Some of it is the Wall Street banks, these ones that were too big to fail. And taxpayer supported their bailing out seem to be rewarding us with extra fees and higher fees for things that we can't quite figure out why we're having to all of a sudden pay the extra fees for. Many of those bigger banks were going to institute new debit card fees where it costs $5 per month just to have a piece of plastic and use it. It would cost larger amounts to have a checking account, and many of them have wisely backed off on that, but they're going to come back at their customers with some other way to try to make money that are basically going to offset earnings that they lost by charging merchants debit card fee swipes. Whenever someone would swipe a debit card fee, the banks would make a bunch of money. It would come out of the merchant's pocket. And so those were reduced dramatically by law, and so the banks are looking for a new way to make money. Also, several other banks and credit unions are struggling, so they can't offer the same terms and levels of service they once did. They might have had a change in ownership. They might have been bought by a new company. But you can definitely take a look at this right now. As a matter of fact, some of the grassroots organizations have come up with a bank transfer day, which is Saturday, November 5th, that has about, I think, 70,000 or 80,000 friends on Facebook right now. Before you do that, though, there can be some issues.
Well, if we're not happy with our current financial institution, where do we start looking?
A lot of places are looking for new customers, and they'd be glad to talk to you. Other large banks are offering incentives, but keep in mind, those incentives can be short-term inducements, and then they can start hitting you with fees on the backside. I would think it's a good time to look at smaller local community banks, and especially credit unions that are in your geographic area and are suffering many of the issues brought about by the bigger banks, but don't have the leverage and the clout that the bigger banks do to try to survive. And so they're actually in very good shape from a financial standpoint. But this is kind of a shop local version of what to do with your money. You can also go online, look at a place like Indirect, and there's a website, findabetterbank.com and findacreditunion.com that can help you do that, and we'll put those up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
All right, so once you've narrowed down the list to a few candidates, then what?
Contact them to see if they are as interested in you as you are in them. Tell, you know, see what their typical account size is, and based on your typical transaction type, if there will be any extra fees above and beyond what you're already paying. Most importantly, read the fine print and find out, if I do this, what happens? Like, if I drop a little minimum balance, how long do I lose all these great privileges, and how can I earn them back?
So assuming you find one that's a good match, what's the next step in switching?
This is really where the rubber hits the road, because it can be a bit of a hassle, especially in the era of online banking. Don't go 100%. Again, don't move all your money over at one time. Maybe move half of it over until all the income and outgo clears from the old place, maybe about 60 days or so until you move all the amount into the new institution. Make sure you check all your automatic payments that they're still going to go out, whether it's bill paying or payments to retirement accounts, and automatic deposit for your payroll deposit coming into the proper new institution. Many of the places who are doing this and are trying to attract new customers have a checklist or even a specialized program set up to make the switch as easily as possible. So see if your new prospective institution has that.
So what about people who maybe don't want to hassle with switching banks at this point, but would like to avoid fees whenever possible?
There's actually a pretty easy way to accomplish a lot of what people are concerned about right now, and that is just to use cash. It's about 6 inches long. It's about 3 inches high. It's green and white. Use cash. First of all, you'll have less trips to the ATM, which are less fees. Less use of the debit card means less fees. The merchant makes more money on cash than he or she will make when you use your debit card, and it's the same cost to you. So if you do give them a $20 bill and get change, or rather than doing a swipe, the merchant will actually make more money. And finally, carrying around cash instead of a plastic and using that for your spending may help you spend less, because if you only can use the cash in your pocket, that's all you can spend.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And let's take a call next from Carol in Wausau. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Joy.
Good morning.
I have both a Roth and a traditional IRA through Vanguard, and I recently received a three-month report from Vanguard, and I've lost a considerable amount of money in both of these accounts. Should I keep contributing to both of these accounts? Should I put the money someplace else? What should I do?
Well, Roth IRAs and IRAs are just jars, vessels or vehicles in which you can put an investment. So just because it's a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA, it does not necessarily mean it will make or lose more money than the other. The quarter which you are referencing, Carol, was probably one of the worst quarters for stocks in the last decade or so. And I'm willing to bet if you went online into your accounts and checked the balances as of last night, you'd be much happier with the amount. That doesn't necessarily mean that you should stay in there, because if you are worried about losing this kind of money again, it can definitely happen again,
right,
as yesterday's action proved. I would rather look at the question of Roth IRA versus traditional IRA in the sense of two prisms. One is taxes. If you are in the 25% tax bracket or higher, which means line 43 on your 1040 is $69,000 if you're married and half that if you're single, then the traditional IRA, putting money into a traditional IRA, is better. If you think you're going to need the money and or you are in the lower tax brackets and you qualify, a Roth IRA is probably a better deal because you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want. But I wouldn't necessarily make the switch or judge the Roth IRA or IRA based on one quarter's worth of investment performance or underperformance, as the case may be.
Okay, is there going to be any difference in a Roth IRA through my local bank and the Vanguard Roth IRA?
Sure. The local bank will probably pay, if it's a traditional CD, they'll pay none percent a year in interest, but you can't really lose anything in that. The Vanguard has a wider array of mutual funds, and I happen to like Vanguard. I think they're certainly a fine establishment. But you are going to find a no chance for gain or loss in the local bank or credit union CDs, whereas the Vanguard has a much better chance of gain and loss in the short and long term.
Carol, thank you very much for the call. Susan in La Crosse is with us now. Hello, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning.
I hear you, Kevin, touting the benefits of an extended mortgage. And I'm wondering, I have no mortgage on my home, but I'm wondering, can I get the same benefits with a home equity loan?
No. I like the 30-year mortgage because it's at a fixed rate. A paid-for home is traditionally a large portion of most people's net worth, and to have all that money locked up in the home, which is an illiquid investment, and even if you do sell it, you still have to find some other place to live. I don't think that that's typically wise, but I'm not against it. Some people are so vehemently opposed to taking out a new loan on their home that it's very difficult for them to do. So the home equity line of credit is the next best step. What you do is you establish it in advance that you can draw from that home equity line of credit, a HELOC, if you will, and at any given time. And you only have to repay interest on it for the time being to keep it current, meaning if you borrow $10,000 and it's, let's say, 5% interest, you only have to pay about maybe $40 a month just to keep it current. The bad news about it is the interest rate is typically adjustable, not fixed, and the banks or credit unions can cap that or even suspend it at any given moment. They reserve the right to do that. So the good news about the mortgage is you have the money, you get to do with it whatever you want. The bad news is you have to start paying interest. So if you just can't get your arms around that, the home equity line of credit is the next best step. And you should get as much as the lender will allow, which is typically probably 40 to 50% of the value of the home.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Susan. Dawn in Madison emails, we have a mortgage that is down to about $5,000 at 5.25% interest. Should we pay it off using our home equity line of credit loan, which is at a lower market interest rate right now?
That's not going to be too big of a deal one way or the other, and I'm guessing their payments will probably knock this off in the next few months. So I would say the fees of probably closing it out and starting up the new one are probably going to offset any savings for it. So no, I would just proceed with the current plan if you're not going to do an actual refinancing into a new mortgage.
Yeah, so if somebody is down to $5,000 on their mortgage, you could refinance and what? You pocket the rest of that money? How does that work?
Yeah, usually, and for people who are interested in not listening to me drone on about it, you can still pledge in any dollar amount and get the On Your Money mini bunny book, Making the Most of Your Mortgage, which will tell you what to do with your proceeds from a new mortgage. That's by sending an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. But typically, setting money aside in retirement, saving it to pay cash for future expenses or future emergencies is the best thing to do with the savings.
And time for Norma in Waukesha. Hi, Norma.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question about 529s for Kevin.
Okay.
I have four great-grandchildren. I moved back to Wisconsin. It'll be just a year ago this week. But before I left the other state, I invested monies in the BlackRock plan, 529 plan, and I do believe it's out of Utah. I found now that here in Wisconsin, that there is a deduction that can be taken if you have a Wisconsin 529 plan. Mm-hmm. You know anything about this or what the difference is in the 529 plans for the children?
I do know anything about it, and yes, you can actually, great-grandparents do qualify for the state tax deduction. It's not huge. It's only a state tax deduction for Wisconsin residents who are great-grandparents or aunts and uncles, and parents and grandparents obviously qualify as well. But it's at EdVest. That's the plan. You can go to edvest.com, EDVEST.com. The state tax break is one feature of the plan. Don't let that be the only one. But yes, you can use that. So if you make a deposit of about, I think, the $3,000 limit in for a great-grandchild, you can deduct $3,000 from your state taxable income. So depending on your bracket, it might save you nothing in taxes, but it might save you maybe $50 to $150.
Norma, thank you very much for the call. A quick email from Christy. She says, I was just singing Mary Poppins to my four-year-old as we were listening to the show, and I loved that the next clip you played was from the movie.
I love the whole franchise, the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Mary Poppins. I love it all.
Yeah, me too. She says, I haven't seen the movie in years and years, and it took one or two notes, but I did place it before Joy identified it, and I loved it. Thank you. Thank you, too, for all the great shows all the time. Well, Christy, thank you very much. That makes our day. Time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we like to try to focus on Wisconsin-based websites if we can, and we will this week. Alice.com, A-L-I-C-E, just like the name, is a privately held website headquartered in Middleton, Wisconsin, and it's a company that does basically most of your grocery shopping for you online. You log in, create a free account, pick out what you want, and they'll ship it to your door within a couple days free in this beautiful blue box. Some of the prices are a little higher than what you might see, but some of the prices are lower, and as long as you get at least six items, there's no shipping charge to it. And what's really neat about it is you might be able to find some items on there that you can't find at your local supermarket. Alice.com, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, sounds good. I have to check that out. I know I'm not going to have to buy mini candy bars for a very long time. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. I believe Kevin is going to be out and about next week, but we'll hear from him the week after that. And tomorrow at this time, we are going to talk about plastic. Plastic is bad for the ocean, according to my guest, Sea Captain, and the author of the book, Plastic Ocean. That's tomorrow between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.